You asked me to so that you can go out there every morning and do what you do, what America needs you to do.
Oh, fuck you, Chip. Fuck you. Don't drag America into this. They've got enough shit to deal with.
This is the Extra Hot Great Podcast, episode 275 for the week of November 4th, 2019. I am America's dad, David T. Cole, and I'm here with 3:30 alarm Sarah D. Bunting. Viral video star Tara Ariano.
I'm exhausted!
And president of the news division, Willa Paskin.
If we're not careful, broadcast news is going to fall off a cliff.
Welcome to Extra Hot Great. Joining us for the very first time is Slate's TV critic, Willa Paskin. Hello, Willa.
Welcome.
Hi. Hi, Willa. Hi. I'm very happy to be here.
Yay! We are thrilled to have you because we are talking about, we booked you to talk about the morning show so long ago before any of us had seen it. And then you started watching it, and I watched on Twitter as you fell in crazy love with it.
So. Yeah, I lost my mind. I'm like fully, I'm so excited. This is all I want to do.
All right. So we're going to talk about all of the Apple TV Plus launches, but mostly the morning show. So we'll lead off with that. So the morning show is the one, if you've seen any marketing for this, probably you've seen most of it devoted to this show. Jennifer Aniston plays Alex Levy. She's the host of a Today Show type of show. And when the series begins, she has just found out that her co-host of 15 years, Mitch Kessler, who's played by Steve Carell, has been accused of sexual misconduct and summarily fired like overnight. And so she has to go on the air and react to this and find another co-host. And there's all kinds of wrangling about this and questions about who dimed him out and what he actually did and is it as bad as it seems and whether he can actually come back. And that's sort of where we leave it. And the person that ends up getting tapped through a series of machinations to be the co-host is Bradley Jackson, played by Reese Witherspoon, who comes up from a kind of obscure Southeastern news network that she's just quit in high dudgeon. And their relationship is not great to begin with either. And the first three episodes dropped. Dave and I watched all 10. I feel like I kind of made him. I know Willa did too. And I feel like we agree the show is not exactly good. And yet, Willa, you tweeted about finding it kind of irresistible. So what is it about the show that makes it so watchable?
So I think there's a lot of things going on here. I do think, firstly, the chances that I would have watched and liked this show if it didn't star Jennifer Aniston and Reese Witherspoon are very little. And there is like they're not movie stars, they're TV stars or whatever. But there is, I mean, I guess Reese Witherspoon is a movie star, but there is something about like everything you're bringing to knowing them and like their that is sort of makes this even like makes it irresistible. I mean, the Jennifer Aniston stuff also kind of gets increasingly meta where like you sort of don't. The beginning, I mean, the show, I have too many thoughts and they're just like jamming up in my mouth. But basically, the show is like really interesting for a lot of reasons because one, you can see the writer's room like changing their mind about stuff all the time. So like it like intermittently, they like just don't know what they're doing. And that makes sense given like what happened sort of behind the scenes, which is that the show went into production sort of based on this Brian Stelter book about the Today Show. And then they stopped production when all the Me Too stuff started happening and basically reworked the whole show and then made this. So, like, I don't actually even know what, like, they were pitched. Right. You know, like, probably something where Steve Carell and Jennifer Aniston were, like, maybe the show that's within the show. Like, Steve Carell and Jennifer Aniston are, like, the anchors and it's all about them trying to bounce the Jennifer Aniston character and hire a new younger woman. But that's not the show that we got. So,
nope.
And you can see them just intermittently, like, they're very, like, how bad can Steve Carell be? How bad can Jennifer Aniston be? Like, and they're working those things through, and they don't know what they think about the answers to those questions, and they have different answers at different points in the season. But over the course of the season, you do sort of see them lean into, like, having a kind of very meta conversation about Jennifer Aniston and, like, everyone sort of thinking they know her and loving her and liking her and what she's really like underneath and also what, you know, feeling owned by the American public like does to a person. So that like in the very last episode, which really ends with like a really glorious, like, network Howard Beale sort of, like, Me Too meltdowns. Pretty engaging. We can get to talk about it. But, like, she's on the street, someone trying to take a photo of her, like, cursing somebody out for thinking that they can, like, invade her space because she's been on their television. You know, there's a lot of, like, this is Jennifer Aniston cursing now. She's not Rachel anymore.
So, yeah, I thought that about when they get to the discussion about how they're going to manage the announcement of her divorce as well, where it's like, oh, this is memorable.
Totally. Like, this is, and also, as someone pointed out, and I had noticed, like, Reese Witherspoon's character is named Brad. Like, it's very, I don't know exactly if they know what they're doing, but, like, they're doing a lot. And that's, like, basically what I felt about the show. It's, like, just doing a ton. Like, there's a lot of, like, also in the first couple episodes, there's a lot of, like, very sort of Sorkin light speeches about, like, the state of television and tech and, like, chaos. And then those speeches all, like, sort of, as the show goes on, sort of become, like, much more Me Too oriented. But I just, like, I'm interested in all of that stuff. I'm interested in watching them, like, try to deal with it. I, like, you know, there's a really, for a long time, it really seems like they're going to try to, like, make Steve Carell, like, not terrible, or, like, let him go on their network. Like, all these just terrible ideas, and then they sort of, like, pull off at the end. I just was really, like, also, it's, like, it's so colorful, and, like, they're famous, and there's, like, 10,000 characters and so much stupid stuff going on, and I was just like, feed it to me, you know? Like, I don't want, this is not dreary. Like, let's do it. I don't know what you, like, it's like, it's not totally off the tracks, but, like, it sort of seems like it might go. So you just get to watch and be like, is this going to completely fall apart? But then you don't actually have that sinking, horrible feeling where it does. It's just, like, entertainingly wobbly the whole time.
That's a great summation, Sarah.
That's the box quote, entertainingly wobbly.
Yeah.
Sarah, what did you think?
This is one of those shows that it's like, there's something wrong here. And I couldn't quite put my finger on it, but it wasn't wrong enough. And there was, like, enough entertaining stuff. Like, it's behind the scenes-y and process-y in the way of, like, books about the late night wars, or the news wars, that I'm like, I feel like I'm seeing something I'm not supposed to see. There is all that meta stuff, which is fascinating. There is, like, I love Reese Witherspoon in this role. But it really is, like, there is this wobbliness that you're like, where are we now? Sometimes, like, I kept making notes about how I could tell in a given scene that we were supposed to find Billy Crudup loathsome and side against him, but he's, like, the only one in the scene making any good points or controlling his emotions. And I'm like, why is this show that is so meta about television and is not on a broadcast service trying to, like, why doesn't it know that I'm siding with, like, the government? Basically, like, it was just very weird.
I have a theory about that, based on our limited time at Bravo back in the day. Everybody's on deck working on a network or a show or whatever, especially at a big place like NBC, General Electric, or whatever. There is a certain quality to the atmosphere there where it is sort of like that Twilight episode where nobody wants to upset the boy because he has magical powers and he could turn into a dog.
Oh, yeah.
Where the only people that are allowed to be genuine and actually truly speak their mind without consequence are upper management. And everybody below them just is like, you're warned, toe the line, or you're going to be on the outside. And maybe that happened to certain people on this podcast.
I don't know what you're talking about.
And I feel like that sort of is where Billy Crudup's character is that he is the only one that can actually, at moments anyways, speak that truth, even if it's just his truth.
Right.
And that dynamic was very familiar to me.
Yeah.
But there is so much else happened. Like, you're exactly right, where, like, the show is trying to put something over, and it's not at all what they put over, but you know what they're trying to put over, where they're like,
the point we made here? And it's like, no, that's not the point you made there.
Or they'll, like, even say, like, they'll be like, wasn't she amazing? And you're like, she was, had very bad dialogue and was barely charismatic in that moment, but, like, okay. Like, you know,
don't do that punchline thing where you're, like, showing people in the audience laughing hysterically, like, okay, Studio 60.
But it's like, you can tell, because you actually know the performers well enough to, like, know what they're capable of, you're like, oh, that wasn't it. But, like, that's just bad, right? Like, it's almost like knowing that they could, that they can be that captivating, like, sort of made it less horrible when the show is pretending that they're a being.
Can I just ask what other people thought of Jennifer Aniston in this role?
I didn't think she was always that good, by the way. I just really, like, thought it was
I didn't
meta.
Either, but I don't think that's necessarily her fault. But Tara is really the professor of Anastonia around here.
Oh, I don't think that's true. I mean, Willa had a whole episode of Dakota Ring, her podcast, all about the tabloid coverage of Jennifer Aniston. So I think she's more of the expert than I am. I thought she was, I could tell that she was happy to be doing something different. It reminded me of when she would do movies like The Good Girl when Friends was still on. And it was clear that she was like trying to stretch. I don't always think that it was successful, but I do agree with Willa that part of that was the writing where they just didn't feel like they had a bead on her the whole time.
Yeah.
And because so much of her character revolves around not just recovering from the Mitch stuff, but also, you know, finding out that she was at risk of getting fired, which he tells her at the end of the first episode, I think, or maybe the second. And that he saved her. And then part of it becomes her desperation to just stay in this job and not get aged out. And so that kind of makes her like weird and brittle too. But I did think they got a couple of things right and that she sold, for example, one of the things that she keeps bringing up is that like she wants a partner. Like Mitch was her partner. They refer to him a couple of times as her work husband, but then she uses that language again with Bradley too, where it's like, you're not my sidekick, you're my partner. And she's trying to like navigate and find meaning in this job that's ultimately like kind of silly. And so I thought that she sold that stuff well, but anytime that she was like trying to be soft, I didn't buy it. Every time that she was really mad, I definitely did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, she doesn't know how to perform cursing. I mean, this is the thing, and I just reread my review of The Good Girl, which I hated, and I'm not going to rewatch it to find out if it's aged better, because I'm pretty sure it didn't. Mm-hmm. I think that it's not that she's cast incorrectly, but when her character is having a meltdown, she defaults to a sitcom-y version of that, because that's what she does. And it's not that she's not good at that, but I don't want to see that here. And the other thing is that there is an extremely like meta squared thing happening with Alex's like likability and sort of the soft trustworthiness as a feminine figure to America, that I think there's like a, you know, Mount Weather shadow version of that happening with Jennifer Aniston every minute she's alive, unfortunately for her. And I would have loved to see her cross those streams and blow it up. And like every time I really felt that they were getting into territory that would unpack what it means for a woman anchor or a woman sitcom actress or a like public figure to like what likability means and what it, like once the word bitch comes in, like they have that moment where she's interviewing Bradley and in her earpiece, they're like, Alex, don't be a bitch. And she's being a super bitch and trying to trip Bradley up. But, you know, what do we mean when we use that word?
Yeah.
About an anchor like Alex or about Jennifer Aniston? And I think that either whoever was directing her or she or the writing or whatever, like, fell away from that, like, lost its nerve.
I don't know. I think that's like really big time what the show is about. Like, I mean, it might just be in the, like, there's a whole like sequence where she like has a screaming fight with her daughter where she like, it's like, fuck you, little kid. Like, I mean, it just, it's like a lot of cursing. I think I mean, you're right that I'm not sure that what they're saying about it is coherent, but it started to feel like that was literally like what the show was. Like the beginning, the first couple episodes, I was like, she's not very good. And Reese Witherspoon is like much better than her, even though she has sort of some more ridiculous things to do. But the show is like so much more interested in Alex, actually, over the long run. Just like, I think basically probably because of like their involvement in the thing and because Jennifer Aniston's like in a TV context sort of more famous, that she like just becomes the focus of the show, and like her figuring, like she is really bitchy, but she also is sort of having this like genuine relationship with Bradley, like a human one. I didn't think it wasn't about that. Like, I think that's what it was about. I'm not, I don't know that I could say that it had anything smart to say about it, but it felt like that was like the thing they were orbiting like almost entirely.
Well, I think it is, like, I think it's trying to be about that, but then I also think that Jennifer Aniston is, you know, this situation, whoever is responsible for it, writing, directing, her acting choices, think that her doing a lot of yelling and swearing means that she's being a bitch, and that it doesn't mean that. It can,
right.
It can.
Yeah.
It doesn't. And it doesn't, it just didn't work for me all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I like her a lot. I think she's very likable as a public figure. I want these things that she tries to do to work, but they just don't quite, because I think there's always this, like, the writers of whatever it is are always like, we can't quite go all the way there because it's Rachel. Like, well,
it just might also be that she's really good at being Rachel. Like, that's yeah. actually her skill set, and it's okay, you know, and she's doesn't want to do that, but that doesn't mean it's not what she's actually really good at. I mean, there isn't a lot of like Racheling in this, though. I mean, it's not that she's so good at the other stuff, but she's not like, there's not a lot of cute, nice Rachel stuff.
No, definitely not. But there is the, one of the most darkly comic moments is in the third episode when it's Bradley's debut on the morning show, and she goes completely off script and just starts talking about like the various, yeah. you know, naughty things she did when she was younger that, you know, show that she's not a pure role model. And one of the things she says is that she had an abortion when she was 15. No one was expecting her to say this, including her mother, who was like listening live and is like, she had an abortion? Like, she didn't know. And I feel like only Jennifer Aniston is playing like this darkly comic moment with like the underplay-y, like it's almost an Arrested Development like her face. I don't know. I thought she was very funny in that moment, which is hard to handle.
There is, that reminds me that's like, there's all these things like, so the whole first episode is sort of, Bradley comes to the attention of the morning show because she has a viral video where she like goes off at a coal protest where she like represents both sides of the argument
yeah.
while screeching. And there's all these like, and this also like with her abortion reveal and sort of on air, there's all these moments in the show where they're like, this would be viral, this would be like get everyone's attention, no one would ever stop talking about this thing, and you're like, would they? Like, it just that's like, that also feels really Sorkin-y to me. They're like, we understand what's cool, then we made a viral video or like a sensation, and you're like, I don't know. Also, like the whole timeline of the show, which is like it all takes place in like three weeks. Days.
Yeah.
Like something totally insane. And then not to like distract us from the depth of this, but I do just want to take this moment to say that like I think Mark Duplass, who plays the news producer, is the worst. He's
yeah.
so unbelievable and smarmy and everything. I cannot believe he keeps getting cast. And he is not plausible in this part at all, like as a smart person, basically,
no.
who's like running the
no.
show.
No, I was saying this to Dave last night when we got to the end, where I was like, he's someone who has that job and has had that job for 15 years, we're supposed to think, would be very powerful. Like, he in real life would be much more like the Billy Crudup character in mannerism and, you know, ability to say the truth. And he's so beleaguered, like he's always scruffy. They put him in these sweaters under his blazers for no reason,
God,
like just to make him look more schlubby. It's like, no, he would be, he's like, you know, that guy is Jeff Zucker. He goes on to run CNN. He's not like this shambling beta male, you know.
He's so bad. I don't understand why he's there. It actually really destabilizes. Like, it's bad. It sets up a lot of things where you're like this. Like, he's the second to last shot of the whole show. Like,
yeah.
You're like, I don't care about that person at all.
No.
Yeah, why didn't they put Justin Kirk in that role? I actually had a note that I was like, who would be better at the, I mean, anyone.
Wait, can I also make another confession about this show? Which is that I now want I want Bradley and Billy Crudup's characters named Corey Ellison to like fall in love. And I felt so creepy about that because the whole thing is like that I'm like, it's fucked up. He's her boss. Do you know what I mean? Like, but I'm just like running a Me Too fantasy where I'm like, but they'll be different. Like, it's fine. He seems like he really likes her. But I do actually want them to get together.
Like he could go run another network and then they could be together.
Yeah, could like happen. Whatever. She's, I mean, I don't know. Oh, that also reminds me of eyeshadow, of eyeliner guy. Yanko? What's his name?
Yeah, Yanko.
I know exactly who you're talking about. For now, forever known as eyeliner guy.
Oh, Nestor.
There's just like a lot going on. You know what I mean? And like the whole Gugu Mbatha-Raw's character, Hannah, like they definitely didn't know what she was at the beginning. And they completely retconned it 100%. Like episode 6, maybe? I don't know. Like somewhere deep into it. But it's,
There could have been a whole other series about Yanko. And just him, like 33 short films about his delusions of grandeur that, I mean, but it's like, I'm going to keep watching it because there's really something, it's like one of those, it's just one of those shows that you're like, what are they doing? It's just fascinating. Like it literally is almost a train wreck that you're like, well, I see the sparks. What's going to happen?
Yeah. It's soapy. It's soapy. It's also trying to be important to varying degrees of success. One of the interesting things, though, is that so much of it is about the Me Too question, and it takes place in the last couple of years, yet there is zero mention of Trump in the whole show, which I found very interesting. I don't know what kind of firewalls they have between Apple and the people that make Apple TV Plus shows, but Apple, the tech company right now, is having a lot of problems with tax tariffs and the Trump government. So it's kind of a bad look, not to mention, you know, the pussy grabbing president that we all enjoy right now in the context of this show.
What did you guys make of, like, did you think it had anything interesting to say about the Me Too stuff?
Well, I mean, I'm going to leave that question to you guys.
Why? Just kidding.
Except for the fact that I felt like they introduced it. They forgot about it for 3 or 4 episodes, and then it comes back towards the end.
Yeah.
As to the actual effectiveness of the story, you guys can talk to that.
I was a little grossed out by the way they did it in that, you know, I can understand, I guess, that the first episode would be Mitch is accused, Mitch is fired, Alex has to pick up the pieces, everyone else has to scramble to keep the show going. But, like, it takes so long for any of his actual accusers to be part of the story that it's like, it really makes it seem like, wow, Mitch's sexual misconduct is the worst thing that ever happened to Alex, which does not seem like the right tack for the show to take.
It almost was even more than that, where you're like, oh, have they decided that he's actually done something bad? Like it felt like to me, like it took them a couple episodes to like know what he had done.
Yeah.
And,
for
and
sure.
to decide whether they were like, like, I felt they had, like, left an avenue open for, like, this to be the story about the guy who's, like, kind of wrongfully accused. Or, like, not, you know,
he's
like...
He's just horny. He's not a criminal.
Right, or they're overdoing it a little. And, like, you know, that was his position, and they definitely have him being wrong. Like, he seems like a blowhard. But, like, you don't, you know, so little for a while, and you sort of are only meeting, you know, all his colleagues are sort of nice about it. You're meeting women that seem like they had sex with him and aren't upset about it.
Yeah.
For so long that you're like, is this the track we're going down? But that isn't ultimately the track they're going down. But it takes them a long time.
It was weird to me that what made the show kind of like of its time, I mean, for better or worse, is like that all of it's mostly about, you know, this sexual misconduct and how it affects this workplace and the people in it and continues to redound. But at the same time, it's set against these real life completely horrible events that are like just treated as window dressing, like, oh, this awful thing happens at the Las Vegas shooting, where it's like, okay, there's no commentary on that. It's just like a thing that happens to be going on in the background while this other thing happens. And like, I mean, I just feel like it might have been in less poor taste for me if they had made up news events rather than had them, you know, revolve around real things that really happened and where people really died in the dozens.
Yeah, or like when they go to the wildfires and then it's just like just about Alex getting divorced.
Right.
Yeah. It is also, I mean, it is, the Me Too stuff is also sort of strange because for the whole sort of back half of the season, they're kind of using like the plot engine becomes like whether or not Mitch is going to be able to successfully take revenge on Angela Chase's dad, Fred Kaplan, the head of the network, also a Steppenwolf actor, Tom Irwin.
He was my Graham in my notes the whole time. Thank you.
Exactly. And you're just like, wait. I mean, and they sort of, he doesn't pull it off exactly, but it is just a weird thing to be driving the show because you're just like, you want me to care about this part coming from this guy? Like, it's fine. I can care about, like, there not being corruption at the network and it going all the way to the top and getting everybody, holding everyone accountable. But when the person driving that accountability train is Mitch, that character, you're like, this suddenly just feels, like, it just seems like a weird structural choice. Like, don't make it that guy and have no one else, like, have a really, like, I mean, I guess Bradley kind of is interested in it for the actual good reasons, but that she's not like the one driving that train. I thought that was strange too.
Yeah, I'll also give the show that it seemed to have an awareness that, like, although all of these bad things are happening to people's reputations, like, all of the powerful people will be completely fine. Like, Corey even says that at some point where he's like, you know, Bradley's like, aren't you worried you're going to get fired? And he's like, I'll be okay. Because he will. Like, they're all rich. They're all fine. Even Bradley is going to be probably fine now. Like, you know, assuming they pay out her contract if she got fired. But
I will say that this is totally unrelated. But when I've been describing the show to people, I keep landing on this moment where Billy Crudup and Mark Duplass are having falafel at the very beginning of an episode, like trying to like hatch a plot to sort of like maybe have Billy Crudup / Corey take over the network so that Mark Duplass can like keep his job, basically. Mm-hmm. And Billy Crudup's character is like, isn't this great falafel? I heard about it on Eater.
I know.
How did you know Eater? Eater's so great. And I literally, it's like so encapsulates everything that's weird about the show. Cause you're just like, I'm sorry, what is going on? Like, is there, like, I was like looking under the table. Like, is there some reason for this to be happening? Like, is Eater paying you? Like, what are you trying to communicate about these characters? That, like, he's cool because he reads it's just, like, so specific. Like, a specific thing they're going for that you're like, I don't understand at all what you could be trying to do. And, like, that the show does that a lot. So it's, like, very, like, astounding. And also just, like, to what end?
Right.
I know you're all down on Mark Duplass, but there is one great moment he has, and towards the end of the show, is not a spoiler, but he eats a hot dog so angrily at one point in the show that I actually guffawed out loud, and I feel like it was like the one truly gif-worthy moment of the whole series. So look forward to that if you're watching the later.
Angry tube steak consumption.
Yep. Yeah. All right, well, let's move on to the rest of the offerings. Let's start with C.
Woo!
Dave, I feel like you should do the plot summary for C. Please tell us what C is about.
All right, so C is set centuries into the future, and sometime around our present day, there is a virus, and it killed everybody in the world except for about 2 million people, and those 2 million people lost their sight because of reasons. And now humanity has devolved into tribes. Some tribes live in the woods in isolation. Some tribes live in hydroelectric dams and masturbate as a form of prayer. And there are so many weird things about this show. This is the kind of show, you watch it, you know it's bad, but in the moment I had so much fun picking out how stupid this show was that I'm kind of really tempted to go back and start watching episode 2, 3 and beyond. When you are building a world as different but familiar as the one in C, it is Earth, but it is Earth a little bit later, and everybody's blind. You have a lot of world building to do. You have a lot of anthropological prediction that you have to make.
Yes.
Some of them are fine. Like, a lot of the clothes are more textural, but then a lot of the clothes have, like, color decorations on them, or the necklaces have patterns of turquoise and other stuff, and they're not textured.
Why?
So, like, there's a lot of weird inconsistencies like that, that sort of, like, huh? Never mind the fact that the whole thing is absurd, and, like, there are a lot of actors here slumming it. It's just such a puzzling mess of a show that obviously started on paper as how can we capture the Game of Thrones crowd now that that show's over, but it fails completely on that front. Like, yeah, it is violent, but the backstory, the sort of the way they handle clans, like there's no nuance to it. It is really kind of like, I think the closest thing of pop culture in the past is probably Waterworld. You know, like, yeah, it is as deep as Waterworld was in a similar setting. It's just like really ludicrous. They didn't really think a lot through. And like moments that they think are serious and tense are goofy and dumb. Like there is a bridge that they all escape out of that is like just in the back of their village and nobody knew about it except for the village doctor for reasons and things they don't explain. Like there's humans now that have like ESP and like super smelling because they bought into that terrible trope that when you lose your sight, apparently everything else heightens, you know? So they're like, I can smell 12 people, 2 kids, 1 dog, and, you know, somebody just farted and they're 450 meters away. That's this show.
You're exactly right about the show, except that it's the stupidest piece of shit I've ever seen. And it's not, like, I would never watch this again ever, under any circumstances. I mean, like, this is a show where it's like, they're wearing like crafted metal helmets. They have no eye holes, but they have like a feather in their cap. And you're like,
yeah,
this is the and then they like are like doing close knife fighting. Like they can't see, like somehow they have not been diminished in their ability to like gruesomely slaughter one another because they're like, I mean, it doesn't make any sense. And it's so dumb. It's so dumb and so grisly. I was just like, this could not be for me less. And I did like watch that first episode or half of it in that way. Where I'm just like, how much dumber could it be? I'll just collect dumb information for like the review I'll never write. But I found it so not fun. I was just like, ugh, this is so stupid. This is so stupid.
Oh, it's not fun.
But it wasn't even fun to watch. Like, I found it too dumb.
Let me put it this way. In the future, like 20 years from now, it's going to be on MSTK 3000.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I said at the time, this can be our capper and then we can move on. But while we were watching it, I was like, I have the same problems with this show that I do with Under the Dome. Hear me out. Which is, if you're going to have a premise that is this high concept, like, I need to trust that you have thought through every single bit of it. And you haven't thought about it at all. And so the idea that these clans are like going to war with each other and, as Willis said, having close combat and there's like no impediment to their fighting. It's like the episode of Under the Dome where it's like, oh, we're going to have underground boxing fights for cash. Like, what possible use could cash have? You are under a dome. Like, think it through. It's very frustrating. Dave, go with God if you want to keep watching this. Not for me.
Fair enough.
All right, moving on. For All Mankind. David, do you want to say the plot summary of this as well?
Sure. So For Mankind is a counter history show. The sliding door of history sort of splits in the mid 60s. And the what if scenario is, what if the Soviet Union was ahead in the space race? Space race never really petered out. It kept going strong. It was like one of the main dick measuring contests of the Cold War beyond the time that it sort of trailed off in our timeline. And the main thrust of the first season is the Soviet Union gets to the moon first. Everybody in America is outraged and sad and bewildered. And then they go to the moon again. And they put the first woman on the moon. And then Nixon's all, well, we got to put a woman on the moon now. And we got to get a military base on the moon. So let's do all that on one mission. Go, go, go. So it's barely sort of a what if. It's not like, what if Hitler survived World War II? You know, what if we went back in time and shot him when he was 16? It's and the ripple effects through history. Like, these are small ripples. Like, if you watch the first 3 or 4 episodes, it is barely different from the historical record, like, of things that happened. Like, it almost feels like you're watching a different version of the right stuff. And then sort of when it gets into recruiting women to be in the NASA program and things that happen after that, it kind of is a little bit different, but it's not, it's really just an exploration of women in the workplace. And it just happens to be this very big, important workplace. That's how it seemed to me anyways.
Yeah. The only thing that I really clocked was that we find out in the first episode that because of the moon scandal, Ted Kennedy canceled the trip to Chappaquiddick, wah, wah. And so it looks like he's going to be the Democratic nominee in 72. But the problem for me is that your lead guy, and it's, you know, very much of an ensemble, but your lead is Joel Kinnaman, and he's so bad. I mean, we've talked about it so many times on the show. Like, he's not interesting.
Stop putting Joel Kinnaman in things.
Or just, like, at least don't make him the hero.
Yeah, it's like a brick of white chocolate with hair. Nobody cares. Stop.
No, he's just supposed to be the boring. Like, he still was kind of good on The Killing, where he was like a weird character. I this thing about this show is just like insanely boring for like what it's about.
Yeah.
And how much effort is put into it. Like, you're just like, this is very dull.
It is. And it is very blah. But Sarah, just for you, they managed to have a police wife trope, except it's an astronaut wife trope, where Joel Kinnaman's wife, whose name is Karen, she looks exactly like Meghan Markle. Thing is like, she's mad that they're even letting women into the astronaut program, like has a huge chip on her shoulder about it, and is like always worried that he's going to the moon. And it's like, he's an astronaut. It's just, you know, we can be done with this. Like, stop making this a storyline. The only way that it gets kind of interesting later is that one of the, you know, she kind of makes friends with the husband of one of the lady astronauts. But I agree, this is pretty boring. Dave, did you plan to continue watching it?
I kind of wish they took a bolder stance on the counter history and made it a little more speculative. It was just slightly phased from our timeline. And that's not terribly interesting, because the story of early Apollo missions and the people that ran it and how it became into being is like well-trod ground. And this isn't that different from all those stories. It's not the most bold of shows.
All right. Finally, Dickinson. Willa, woo-hoo! I know you watched this one too. Why don't you describe what the show is about?
Dickinson is a teen show set in a period. What is Emily Dickinson alive? I'll redo
Well, it's pre-Civil War.
Mid-19th century?
Yeah. This is a teen show set in pre-19th century Massachusetts that is ostensibly about Emily Dickinson. I don't want to that's actually what it is. I'm not being like it's a teen show about Emily Dickinson. And that's kind of the whole thing. It's totally, to me, about the show, it's like fairly to totally implausible that Hailee Steinfeld, who plays Emily Dickinson, could actually be Emily Dickinson, that this character has any wrenching, deep, artistic inner life. But I found her extremely charming as like a 2019 teen girl, like deposited in a period show that like has the energy and verve of like a teen drama. Like, it's very, like, it's very, there's a genuinely like sort of jangly juxtaposition of those two things where you're like, whoa, everyone is out of time. Like, Jane Kazmierak's here and she's like just being herself, but she's like a period mom. Like, it's very weird, but it kind of works. And the whole thing is like every episode basically takes, I mean, I've only seen the first three. Those three episodes like almost take like an actual sitcom trope. Like, the parents go away for a part, like you have a house party without your parents, or like,
yeah.
Like the sitcom thing where you build a volcano, literally, like where that's only ever happened in sitcoms. And then they like put them into like the mid-19th century. And like, so instead of doing like Molly, they're doing opium. It's like, and everyone's very queer. And it's like, honestly, I found it very delightful. But like, I think it's better than The Morning Show. But I don't like know that it's actually like good. It's just like very, it's like got a lot of energy. It's like very lovely, kind of.
We watched them all. I do think it gets better after the first three episodes. It's weird that those are the three that like they stopped after that, because episode four has Emily and her friend George going to meet Henry David Thoreau, and he's played by John Mulaney.
Amazing.
He's delightful.
God. Okay.
I mean, I feel like it's definitely very busy. I don't know if I would say it's better than, I guess it is better than The Morning Show. I agree. But I felt like we probably should have taken breaks. We just watched all 10 back to back, like in one evening. And we probably should have spaced them out, because by the end I was sort of like exhausted by the, you know, jokey anachronisminess of it. But she's very charming. She's quite likable. And, you know, Dave had critiques about the handwriting that I should throw to him.
Dear Mr. President, there are too many states nowadays. Please eliminate three. I am not a crackpot.
If your character is going to be writing notes, and also you're going to display her poems on screen, which is supposed to be her handwriting. Two things. One, spend the money to get a proper handwriting font developed. They're easy to do and it's not expensive. So if you have two E's together, go to the trouble of having two different E's in your font so you can't tell us, obviously, from a computer. The thing that really bugged me, though, in the first episode, she passes a note to her best friend, Sue, and the note is in a totally different handwriting from the poems that she writes on paper in her bedroom. Prop apartment, talk to each other. If you got one team on the Sue note and you got another team on the poems, make sure that the same person is writing it down, because it was like from two different people. It doesn't take a lot of work to get the fonts to look the same across the show. Thank you. I am not a crackpot. This was also my favorite show, not that notwithstanding. I thought it was really well done. Yeah. Willa kept on saying it was like a team drama, but it's also like Clueless-y too. Like there are elements of that, like especially the house party episode. I could have probably done without the overwrought death stuff. You know, the actual physical manifestation of the carriage and everything. It wasn't steampunk, but I had the same reaction to it as I do to steampunk stuff, which is like, stop it with this shit.
Yeah.
Is it Wiz Khalifa who's playing Dash?
Yeah.
I don't know who that is, but okay.
I do find, like, I thought that was like, I was like, is this veering towards somewhere like kind of weird? I don't know. I wasn't wild about that. It is definitely like a teen comedy. Yeah. It's pretty fun.
And I really liked the supporting cast. Her family's really good. The father, Jane Krakowski as the mother, her sister.
Oh, did I call her
Lavinia?
Jane Kasmariak before? I did.
It's okay.
One of you should stop me. I knew, I was like, they'll tell me when I'm wrong. And then one of you guys, you all knew it.
You kept talking. I couldn't break in. But yes, it is Jane Krakowski from 30 Rock.
They're like the Jane with the long K's.
And just to put a cap on this, I also watched one episode of Snoopy in Space. It was fine. It was a nice little show. And it was weird, though, because it had a lot of crossover with some of the stuff in For All Mankind. You know, it was like we just watched the For Mankind where Von Braun, the former Nazi scientist who came over to the U.S., develops the space program. And the Peanuts Gang is doing a play about all the same stuff. And it's like, well, I guess they edited that in the Charlie Brown universe.
And that's Apple TV Plus.
Yeah. All right, this week it is a very short Around the Dial. We're going to one stop, and that is Sarah Diamond.
Hello. So Great British Bake Off / Great British Baking Show has concluded its most recent series. Was anyone else watching it?
Me.
Well, I'm glad that someone else can perhaps talk me through what I'm feeling, which is not having any problem with the winner. Which he was definitely one of those contestants that if you watch enough of this show, there's usually one like this. He's like a very competent in the early going, and he looks like the horse to bet. And then he usually gets swept out in like episode 4 or something because he uses salt instead of sugar and he can't come back from it. That didn't turn out to be true. He hung on the whole time. Good for him. But the whole season felt a bit flat and forced in a way that it hasn't before to me. I have no kick with the new hosts either, but Sandy in particular seemed to be, if not phoning it in, just kind of tired and off her game. I've spent a few months now trying to articulate the vague feeling that the season was not bad, but also not as good. I have not put my finger on why. Dave, did you feel the same? And if so, did you have any theories about?
I could see where you're coming from with the hosts being a little tired. I did feel like they were doing more scripted stuff, or at least it seemed more scripted. Maybe it's all scripted and they were just doing a better delivery of it in the past. I think one of the problems with this season is that we had a couple bakers that dominated the whole season. Steph won like 3 in a row. And David. Yeah. David.
Wow.
He consistently came in second in a whole bunch of things. So like there wasn't a lot of standing shifting. So it seemed like we were just like coasting towards an inevitable Steph David final, which ended up being the case. So I felt like, you know, there wasn't just a lot of drama in the, you know, who's going to go home part of it. It didn't really matter because you knew who the last couple were going to be from early on in the show. One of the, I don't know if it was a problem, but like the way they structure how they judge, you could have somebody win 12 of the 13 bakes and just totally fuck up on the last one and lose. Mm. Like, I kind of felt like before the last episode that Steph definitely was going to take it home because she seemed like the strongest baker. She got the most accolades of all the people that said, like, this is the most amazing thing that I've tasted. You're an excellent baker. She was the one getting those comments. The other ones were like, you know, you did good this time, and then they would fuck up the next time. Like, they weren't consistently good with their baking. And she seemed like she was a natural talent, and she was doing good work. She just happened to not do the best work at the end. So,
yeah,
like, insofar that it is like the Super Bowl, it's kind of frustrating sometimes, you know, that only the last game counts.
Right.
And I feel like that's this season suffered from that, because I really kind of felt like, when looking at the whole season, Steph should have won, for sure.
Yeah, I've never had any problem with the fact that they really are, like a lot of reality shows say this and then don't admit that they're judging cumulatively. Like, just tell us what the parameters are and we'll accept them or not. But like on Project Runway, it's like, oh, day you're in, the next day you're out. Like, that's not really true.
Yeah.
There's like wheat and chaff from the jump. We're just not told how the decision is made. I've always appreciated that with this show, it really is how you do that week. But there were also a couple of eliminations this series that I was like, what? Like, that I couldn't see how they happened, or why they happened when they did. And it did seem like gaming it in a way that I hadn't seen before. So yeah, there was just something off this year.
The other thing I felt, and maybe I'm just, you know, there's a lot of different challenges, but I felt like there weren't a lot of very familiar basic kind of items that were made. Like, a lot of the technical challenge were stuff like we'd never hear of. Like, there's like wafers on top of little donut balls and like all this shit. Like, I'm sure if you're into baking, you know these things, but like once in a while, not that I know what they are, but like a couple of seasons ago, they did like Jaffa cakes, which are basically like, you know, as common as cupcakes or something here, right? It's just like a basic British treat. Like, more like that once in a while, so that you can kind of get back into it. And then you, as the uninformed baking novice, can sort of just like judge it. Well, that looks like a good donut. You know, like, why? Like, that's the kind of thing. Once in a while, I feel like they have to reset the expert level, you know, to basic, so that you can get kind of jump back into it.
Yeah. And don't make it so like the official, midday dessert of Napoleon III's court.
Exactly. Yeah.
No one cares. And it's like, oh, and then you have to do pink striping. Fuck out of here. Like, just have them make a tiny souffle every now and then to keep everybody honest. For my plug, I have made the official dessert. Just kidding. It's actually for my podcast, Quaid in Full, in which I am reviewing every single thing Dennis Quaid has ever done in front of a camera. We're about to wrap up season one, the 70s, this week with, finally, a legit good movie, Breaking Away. So look for that wherever you find your podcasts. And then we'll be on a break. And then we're back with a film called Gorp. So
Gorp,
pray for me. And also, once again, it's called Quaid in Full, and you can follow the podcast on Twitter at Quaid in Full Pod.
I'm sorry, before we move on, Gorp, G-O-R-P, is it a science fiction movie?
No, I think it's from 1980, so it's from like Meatballs did pretty well, so then there were like 78 versions of Meatballs.
Got it.
Oh, okay. So it's like trail mix.
Yeah.
Got it. Willa, what would you like to plug?
Oh, I host a podcast for Slate called Decoder Ring. And it's good. And you guys should listen to it. It comes out every month. We have one coming out just this week, and then we'll have another one. And then we won't have one for the holidays, and then we'll have some more.
Can you say what the topic of the next one is?
Yeah, sure. It's about gender reveal parties, actually. So the show is like about cracking cultural mysteries. And we do like, it's a documentary culture podcast. So it's a ton of reporting and interviews and clips and narration. And we've done episodes about, like, for example, why are Brad Pitt and Jennifer Aniston still getting married on the cover of tabloids? Or like, what happened to the laugh track? Or why clowns got scary? Or why do people have so many pillows on their bed on HGTV shows? But yeah, this one is about like why gender reveal parties are a thing. It's kind of killing me, but it will be done soon, and then we'll be on to something else.
Yay. If this sounds familiar, it's because back when Adam Sternberg was on the last time, when we were talking about the Righteous Gemstones as our lead topic, we had a Sherlock presentation in the canon, and we talked about Willa's episode on the John Locke conspiracy, which is an all-timer. So check it out, Dakota you. Ring. It's great.
It is time for the canon. Submitting this week, it is listener Kit. Take it away, Kit.
Hello, Extra Hot Great, Sarah, Tara, Dave, valued guest and or guests. I'm here to talk to you today about an excellent episode of television, Season 1, Episode 5 of American Vandal, which I believe belongs in the canon. The first season of American Vandal is very nearly perfect. A quick description for those who don't watch. American Vandal is a serial-style documentary about a horrific miscarriage of justice that rocks the small town of Oceanside, California to its core. Namely, somebody spray-painted a bunch of dicks on all the cars in the Oceanside High teacher's parking lot, and student Dylan Maxwell, the kind of classic deadbeat loser, has been accused, found guilty, and expelled from his senior year of high school based on circumstantial evidence. Peter Maldonado, a junior in the AV club, decides to document his quest to find out hashtag who drew the dicks and clear Dylan's name. A huge part of what makes American Vandal successful is its creator's ability to combine imagery, tone, and topic in a way that feels accurate to the crime documentary genre, and also takes full advantage of that genre's tropes. The whole series takes the central crime of spray-painted dicks every bit as seriously as Dateline or 48 Hours take a grisly murder of the week. There are CGI crime scene recreations, dramatic music cues, slow motion and close-up shots, an evidence-covered corkboard, everything a good crime doc needs. The series uses these tropes to phenomenal effect for episode 5, Premature Theories, in what I think is maybe the series' best episode. In episode 5, the investigation has reached a turning point. The documentary has gone viral, and the influx of popularity has brought some significant changes to the project. Both Dylan and Peter have been getting lots of public support.
Our boy Dylan. You are the motherfucking man. Stay strong, bro. Your biggest fan. I think there was like some Facebook group with my address in it. People have just been sending me all these letters and shit of like pictures of dicks. And there's like a bunch of vaginas too. Look at this shit. Look how skinny this vagina is. This one's like sad vag. This one's more of like a shocked vagina. A lot of them have hair, you know, in honor of my drawings. The ladies just kind of love me, I guess.
I got a bunch of emails myself.
Oh, vaginas?
No. I just got a bunch of fan theories. Hashtag who drew the dicks is trending on Twitter.
Really?
You can't see it because this is a podcast, but the shocked vagina drawing is a masterpiece well worth the cost of your Netflix subscription. In fact, all of the design work in this show is impeccable, from the mismatched linoleum on the floor in Dylan's house, to the social media handles of the people making comments on the documentary, to the knickknacks on the shelves in Nana's house. In a quick, delightful montage, we see the fallout from the documentary going viral. There are suddenly YouTube fan channels, tweets about possibly guilty parties, and even a Ferris Bueller-style t-shirt campaign to free Dylan. We also get reminded that Dylan's not the brightest crayon in the box.
Dick deniers. Yo, these people are saying there was never any dicks and it was just Photoshop. You think about that?
Well, I mean, people were there. They saw the dicks, so...
I mean, I didn't see him. Did you see him?
It was on the news.
One of those fan theories that Peter decides might be valid is that Dylan and his friends, the Wayback Boys, planned the dick painting prank at a party 3 days prior to the vandalism. The party, which has been teased since the first episode, was over-the-top absurd teenage debauchery, going down in school legend as Nana's Party, because it was held at Rachel Balducci's grandma's house.
Yo, Nana's Party was insane.
It was lit as fuck, man. There's titties, beer, a lot of candy. Dudes were dressing up in Nana's clothes.
Like, mad props to Rachel for fucking ruining her Nana's house like that. Because we destroyed that place, dude.
I just feel so bad for Rachel Balducci's grandma. Like, seriously, her house is fucked. It's fucked.
Nana's Party was all over social media. Ari's sister brought weed from Vermont. Ryan Gold drank a fifth of vodka. Julia Perez wasn't wearing a bra. And she shit on the floor. Everyone from school was there. Well, everyone but me and Sam.
Also, I have to shout out the actor playing Dylan's friend Spencer. He's the guy who's excited that the party has titties and candy. He is an expert stoner deadbeat loser in every single second of his screen time for the entire season, and he is brilliant. Nana's Party sets the stage for what I think is the series' most impressive sequence, and the reason why I think this episode is canon-worthy. In order to figure out whether witnesses really did overhear Dylan planning the dicks, Peter meticulously constructs a beat-by-beat breakdown of Nana's Party, pieced together with social media posts, cell phone footage, and, of course, CGI crime scene recreation, all cut together against a B-roll of Nana's old lady house. Peter spots a can of spray paint identical to the one used to paint the dicks in the background of a video and calls his friend Sam.
Hey, you've reached Sam Eklund, a.k.a. Ketchup Packet. Sorry I missed your call. I'll call you back or, you know, just text me. It'll probably be easier.
Hey, Sam, it's Peter. I got some evidence that I thought you may be interested in, so if you want to give me a call when you get a chance, that'd be great. I'd love to fill you in. Okay, bye.
I told Sam that we had some evidence. That's a bit of an undersell. This is the Holy Grail, the murder weapon.
Again, what they're talking about here is a can of spray paint that was used to draw a bunch of penises. Peter and Sam create a timeline of the entire party and trace the can's path through the party minute by minute. Because all of the evidence comes in the form of Snapchats and Instagrams and all those other things that the kids these days are getting off my lawn with, the party sequence is a treasure trove of character detail, foreshadowing, and clever callbacks. American Vandal is excellent at weaving in the types of petty rivalry and complex social networks that are part and parcel of high school. Though they never come much into play with the major plot lines, characters like Pat Micklewaite and Ming Zhang show up again and again. Ming is everybody's best friend. Pat is an unassuming dork who Peter clearly resents, and it's hilarious.
The first one is going to be key. It's clear that they're still planning something on the couch, while Pat Micklewaite talks to Julia Perez and Ali Cabrera, which also means that Pat Micklewaite was invited to this party. So, good for Pat, I guess.
The whole episode works because the relationships between the various characters all seem so fundamentally real, even though they are set against the absurd backdrop of the dick investigation. Hearing Peter dramatically reconstruct the Wayback Boys conversation from Facebook Live footage and background audio from a couple students Snapchatting is the kind of juxtaposition that makes American Vandal so successful time and time again. The out-of-control party is narrated and scored with all the gravity of Lester Holt foreshadowing the next murder a serial killer would commit. But the viewer never gets the sense that the drama is for show. Peter truly cares about Dylan and about getting to the bottom of the mystery of who drew the dicks. The tone, over the top as it might be, comes from the heart. Peter's earnest quest for justice is the series' best feature and makes the entire series worth watching. What puts this particular episode over the edge into canonicity, for me though, is the sheer volume of detail and care taken in constructing Nana's Party. The party is seen from so many different angles and points of view, and yet every single moment feels authentic. The party feels real. And the background characters all feel fully realized, even if we never really meet them outside of the party. There's no feeling that this is a big house full of extras. Every single actor seems to be telling a fully fleshed out story, from the guy with the guitar to the three jocks holding a fashion show in Nana's clothes to poor Nick Cotterman with his head stuck in the banister.
Stuck. I'm fucking stuck. You gotta get me some fucking butter.
It might be the most realistic party I've ever seen on TV, because everything from the acting to the set dressing to the choices made about filming is so well thought out. The clips weave together effortlessly, moving the plot forward without feeling convenient or constructed. And you really buy that Sam and Peter had to weed through hours of footage to create their timeline. There are other important things that happen in this episode, but Nana's Party is absolutely the jewel of the series. I hope that you agree. I hope that you enjoyed the episode. And I hope that you'll induct it into the canon.
Thank you, Kit. Now, who on the panel wishes to go first to start our discussion?
I would love to lead this discussion. This was a wonderful presentation. Thank you so much, Kit. I agree that this really does underscore what makes this series, or season one of this series, in my opinion, really brilliant. We tend to say this when we're talking about documentary now, but it's satirizing the genre from a place of abiding familial love. And it's so smart about the way it does it. Like, the when she's talking about the texture of Nana's Party, to set a project like this in a high school, and to not take something like the Dicks, to not trivialize it, because if you're in that milieu and you have kind of nothing else to think about except AP bio and whoever is next to you at your locker and stuff like that, like, this is the perfect milieu to put this story in and have the characters take it with this investigative seriousness. It's cast amazingly. I completely forgot that Alex Trimboli was Callum Worthy, who of course is in the act, and like, everyone is really fully realized. I wouldn't have put it like that, but she's absolutely right that that party feels like it really was a documentary, like it really did happen. The way that the kids talk about the case and the party and each other is amazing. I love Sam and Peter's relationship. Also, it's not as much in this episode, but I do think this is a good episode because of the way that, for the canon, because of the way that it highlights all the properties that it's parodying, like this extremely granular explication of the timeline is very Making Maura Murray. There's references to Serial, there's references to The Jinx, there's references to 48 Hours. The credits are extremely self-serious and therefore hilarious, just like Dylan sort of brooding, but also just being Dylan. Like, it could be brooding, he could be farting. That's the beauty of Dylan. I was thrilled to revisit this for the canon. I definitely wanted to keep watching to the end of the season, even though I've seen it a couple of times before. This was a fantastic episode and a great presentation. And I am definitely voting yes, because I think that this this property, I'm sad that it's no longer with us, because I think there was more for them to do. But what they did do, I think, was really, really good and really loving towards the genre while sending it up hilariously. And you just get to say dicks a lot of times, and you can't be mad at that. Willa, what did you think?
You know, it's so interesting. I basically agree with every single thing everyone has said. That presentation was amazing. I think the show is really great. I think, like, coming from a place of satire, coming from a place of love, like the preciseness of it, the exactitude of it, all of it is true. But I did just, like, it made me think that you can't take an episode of American Vandal. Like, it just made me, when I was watching, I just wanted to watch the next one. And I also sort of thought, like, it wasn't funny in the way that, like, I remember the first couple, like, the actual, like, firstly, I think Dylan is by far the funniest character in that show, and he's actually not in this episode a ton. And, like, the very initial episodes where you're like, you're doing this? Like, you're going to go in about the do the dicks and, like, just the talking about the, like, is so ridiculously funny. And this is, like, almost in the middle of it to me where it's like, you know, when someone says something, like, so many times, like, at some point it stops being funny before it starts being funny again. And this is almost like the meat where it's like, they're just doing it. It's totally straight faced, you know, but you're not like, I wasn't like hysterical about it anymore. I think it's very, like, it's very good, but it just felt to me like it was just a piece of something that is so much bigger. Like, it just made me think, oh, this is like maybe not a show that's about episodes.
Yeah, that is the one I would say drawback to the canon argument is, like, how do you pick just one, especially since their, like, crazy wall moment in this episode is not about the like the drawing of the dicks and how Dylan's have pubes on them. Like, I mean, it's tough. Not too tough, though.
I mean, I think it's very good. And I was like, oh, I want to watch it. I mean, I've also seen this show before and I was like, let me just keep going. I'm like, it's very good. But I just didn't. Like, I was just like, this just felt like, it just felt like if you came to this cold, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know if you would like it.
Your reaction to this episode is sort of similar to my reaction of the second season, which I kind of felt like they took a different tone and it just wasn't as goofy and funny. And I just couldn't get into it as much. I feel like this might be that sort of just on a smaller scale.
I mean, season one is sort of like a victimless crime, like not if you have to have your car repainted, but whatever. And season two was like, all right, well, that could have killed somebody. So
that's a public health issue.
Yeah, exactly.
Char.
I take Willa's point. I understand what you're saying. I don't disagree. But I would say what makes this episode different for me is that, and it's something actually that Kit didn't really talk about, which was, I mean, she talked about the social media aspect of, you know, using everybody's snaps and Instagram and Facebook Live to reconstruct the conversation and, you know, to get a timeline of what was happening when at Nana's party. But what made it a turning point for me was the way it's shown at the beginning of the episode where it's like, now the show is commenting on itself. It's portraying what the reception of the American Vandal series is within, like, the social media ecosystem of our time, and, like, showing all the after shows and the commentary and, like, the fan videos and stuff.
Which,
like,
now is, yeah, which is an element of the true crime more podcasts.
For sure.
But that's part of what I like too.
Yes. I mean, the stuff with Mr. Krabs being like, oh, I never would have said those things.
Oh God, that guy.
This big. Poor Mr. Krabs, idiot. But I agree with, I don't have much to add other than that. Kit is right that the staging of the party is, the ambition of it is amazing. And not just in terms of, like, the precision of where things had to be. I mean, obviously some of that was reconstructed and planted, duh. But it felt so real. And how I knew it was real was that it stressed me out. I was the teen who never had a party at her parents' house because she was afraid of it getting fucking wrecked like Nana's house was. But also, like, just, you know, that Peter and Sam are still bitter that they were, like, apparently the only two kids at their whole school that didn't get invited. I mean, it just feels, it's true crime, but it's also true teens. And so I can see where Kit is coming from with the presentation, and I loved it. So thank you. Dave.
To Willa's argument, I feel like if you take this episode and think of it in context of the season, that we had all this goofy shit happen at the start when we're introduced to the dicks and all these crazy characters, that the absurdity of having such a point by point, lovingly recreated true crime A&E style documentary series recreation of it is inherently funny. Like, I find that very funny, not ha-ha funny, but I find, like, it is such a lovingly crafted piece inside of this absurdist season of, you know, faux documentary parody or whatever is going on, that it is still funny. And within that recreation, with all these sort of monochrome, basic polygon recreations of the house and watching the spray can move around like Billy and the Not Me Family Circus cartoons and all that kind of crazy stuff. Like, I did find that funny. It is a different sort of funny that you get at the beginning of the season, but you need it, right? I mean, I think you need this sort of recreation, this sort of beat by beat forensic breakdown of the crime of the party, rather, to sell the season as a whole. And I think it's such a well-crafted episode. Granted, they were able to create all the events of the party and put it all together, but it seems real. And
yeah,
with the meta commentary that goes on with at the beginning with Dylan and the letters, and then you know, it just feels genuine. It is obviously loving, but it's still funny. It's not as ha-ha funny as you got, but I still think it's a very important part of the season and really sells the series as a masterpiece of a parody. I wasn't really that impressed with the second season. I don't remember much from it, but I remember this season a lot. And this episode made me want to do a rewatch immediately. With that, let's put this to the official vote. Sarah D. Bunting, what say you?
Absolutely yes. Thank you, Kit.
Willa?
Oh my God, it could be. Do I have to vote?
Yeah, you gotta say, is it canon worthy or not canon worthy?
All right, no, just the theme is interesting, but I think it's really good.
All right, Tara Ariana?
I vote yay.
All right, and I am gonna say yay too. So by vote of 3-1. That means American Vandal season 1, episode 5, Premature Theories. You are hereby inducted into the Extra Hot Great Canon.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It is time for Winner and Loser of the Week. Sarah has the winner.
I do. Speaking of true crime, Julia Garner is going to star as Anna Delvey, a.k.a. Anna Sorokin, in Betsy Pierce and Shonda Rhimes' Netflix series based on Jessica Pressler's reporting about the Summer of Scam star, quote unquote. Julia Garner was also in Dirty John. She was one of the best things about it. This is like 180 degrees away from that character wise, but I'm confident in her. I'm a little less confident in Katie Scandal Lowe's being Rachel Deloach Williams, but maybe that was just her Scandal character that I didn't like. So,
well, the character description did sound a lot like that.
Yeah.
Did you read it? Like, it just sounded so intense. I was like, I could see that. Not to interrupt, but like, I was like, oh, I vary that vibe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I'm excited about that. And yeah, good casting.
And loser of the week?
Loser of the week is Dave's girlfriend, Gina Torres, because her spinoff, Pearson, a spinoff of the show Suits, is not coming back. Dead after one season.
I didn't even know that existed, I don't think. So that's not good either.
Probably. Yeah, I like her, but I didn't make it all the way through the pilot either. Like, I think I watched 2/3 of it and was like, I get it. But, you know, she'll be fine.
Speaking about, I get it. Do you know what time it is?
Game time?
It's game time.
All right, everybody, this is the second game time of the season. Last week, value guess won. So our standings are value guess 1, everybody else 0. Today, we are playing the day after, before, and after from me, who earns himself nothing for doing content on his own podcast. We've done many before and after style games, and I'm finally throwing my hat into the ring. Today, we have 33 questions over 8 themed rounds. I'll explain the theme for each as we get to them. So to remind you how before and after works, here is an example. You need to figure out which two show titles run together from this description of the merged show. So here's that description. Bionic Man Steve Austin finds himself in an alternate reality where the Nazis won World War II and are occupying America. What's the name of that merged show?
$6 Million Man in the High Castle?
$6 Million Man, Man in the High Castle, merged those together, $6 Million Man in the High Castle.
That I would have kept watching.
One note, sometimes the definite article, the, is dropped from titles to make things work. Not many, but once in a while you will encounter that. Tara Ariano, can I get the steel meal situation, please, with an explanation of that?
Yes. The steel meal is if someone else answers wrong and you know the answer, you can jump in and say steel meal and you can steal that point. Valued guest has one steel meal. I have one steel meal. Sarah has three steel meals.
Let's throw it to our person in control, choosing initiative, Picky, to see who it will go first today.
We will start with Sarah.
All right. Our order today, Sarah, Willa, Tara, are we ready to play the day after before and after?
Yeah.
Yes.
Round one is just a normal before and after. I'm going to give you a description of two shows. You merge them with a new title. All right. So we'll start you off easy. Sarah D. Bunting.
Yes.
A Jersey mob family deals with a supernatural predator with a vanity license plate.
A supernatural predator with a vanity license plate.
Correct.
Okay, well, I'd feel like a New Jersey mob family is The Sopranos, but don't know. So, Sopranosferatu? I don't know.
Oh, yeah! Really? Yeah!
Sopranosferatu. Yes, Sopranos.
Oh, of course.
Is correct, 1 point.
Ooh. Yikes.
All right, this is for, you know what? I screwed up the order. Let's do Tara, then Willa, because I don't have time to edit the spreadsheet.
Okay.
Tara.
Yep.
A loosely connected anthology series full of scares, gore, and a former 90s primetime soap star's family.
American Horror Storytelling?
That's not what we're looking for. We have American Horror Story and Dean is the show we're looking for.
Okay.
Wow.
Dean? What is Dean?
That's Tori.
Dean
and
is Tori's
Dean.
Husband.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Oh my God. I'm going to get this is so wrong now. I'm very excited to be.
All right. Willa, here is your first question ending round one. Yeah. He figures out how to get out of jams with paper clips, wads of gum, and a toilet roll. She solves crimes in Southern California. They used to be friends a long time ago.
It's like, okay, I understand what the second one is. And I also, it's MacGyver Monica Mars. MacGyver Veronica Mars.
MacGyver Veronica Mars. Nailed it, 1 point. All right, that is round one. Round two, your theme is the help can help. The answer will involve at least one butler, maid, nanny, housekeeper, helper type of TV show.
Oh, my Benson answer
Who
is
may
waiting.
Come up?
So here we go, starting with Sarah. An affluent African-American family closes down their dry cleaning operation to get into the drug trade with their new motorcyclist buddies.
The Jeffersons of Anarchy?
Yep.
Would watch.
Wow.
Nice.
Correct.
Round of applause. That was good.
All right, Tara.
I'm serious.
Yep.
Cleaning the manor and serving supper has become so much easier since the new hire with that twinkly nose appeared.
Oh, no. Twinkly Nose is Bewitched, I think, but I don't know what the other half is. I don't know.
Steel Meal.
Steel Meal from Sarah.
Downton Abbey Bewitched.
Downton Abbey Bewitched is correct.
Nice.
To Willa, her first The Help Can Help question. Mm-hmm. Jenna Elfman, Bull Pullman, and Josh Gad are a dysfunctional family living at a famous address. Their butler solves a lot of their problems, some with gentle English charm, some with brass knuckles and pistols.
some with gentle English charm and some with brash knuckles. And I know what the first one is. I've watched that show, although I
let,
not
let the people
it,
like, know 16, listening what you think that first show is.
It's like 1600. What was it called? 1600 Pen. Okay, so what's this? So 1600 Pen, and then what's the other? What is it?
Their butler solves a lot of their problems. Some with gentle English charm. Some with brass knuckles and pistols.
Oh, it's who's Batman's dude?
I bet you know what it starts with.
Yeah, no, it's Penny. Oh, right. Okay, so 1600 Pennyworth.
Nice.
That is correct. 1 point. Okay. That was some good thinking through. Yeah. Sarah D. Bunting.
Yeah.
You get a show that Benson was spun off, and you get a show that Benson was spun off from.
Sopra.
Sopra Winfrey Show. We'll accept that answer.
That was an elegant clue, by the way, David T. Cole.
Soap and the Oprah Winfrey Show combined. Back to Tara.
Yep.
An Ivy League school is the setting for the solution to America's race relations problems when an old wise white butler teaches everyone the self-affirming power of sitting on one's own balls.
Oh, no.
Let me read that again for you.
Well, I feel like it's Dear White. It's Mr. Belvedere and Dear White People, but how did Mr. Belvedere White People?
That is how it's done. Oh. Mr. Belvedere, Dear White People.
Oh.
Back to Willa, still on The Help Can Help. Nell Carter plays a homekeeper for a widowed police chief and transforms herself from mother figure to drug kingpin to support them all.
I'm definitely not going to know what this is.
Oh, okay. We'll give it a shot.
I don't even know what show Nell Carter was in, so I definitely can't even start. Sorry.
All right. Sometimes that happens. Steel meal from Tara.
Steel meal. Give me a Breaking Bad.
Give me a Breaking Bad is correct.
Nice.
Tara with the steel for one. To Sarah. I'm so glad you got this one. Okay. With apologies in advance. Patricia Arquette investigates the story of a lovely fembot who is upgrading three very lovely robot girls. All of them has circuitry of gold like their mother. The youngest one has Earls.
Patricia Arquette? Can you read the beginning of the clue again, please?
Patricia Arquette investigates the story of a lovely fembot who was upgrading three very lovely robot girls. All of them has circuitry of gold like their mother. The youngest one has Earls.
That's well done, and that clearly refers to the Brady Bunch, but I don't understand where... Oh, God, what was the other goddamn thing that she was in? All right, it's the Brady Bunch. Medium is stuck in my head, and I can't get it out of there. But it's the other thing with the prison, and I can't remember it. I don't know. Someone steel meal this, please.
Anybody?
It's not.
Fuck, what is that one called?
I don't have a steel meal.
All right, the answer we're looking for, CSI Cyber Brady Bunch.
Oh, Dave. That was a really good clue, though.
That was a tough one. I thought you were going to get that one. Tara Ariano.
No one remembers she was on that show.
Yeah.
A dim-witted urchin has a cunning plan to break out of a privately run women's prison.
Orange is the new Blackadder.
Correct.
Crushed.
This one is for Willa, and we'll end round two. And again, apologies in advance.
Uh-oh.
Now, this is a story all about how my life got flipped, turned upside down. And I'd like to take a minute, just sit right there, and I'll tell you how I became the pilot of a highly advanced CIA-funded helicopter weapon program.
Well, so it's the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, but... So it must be Air something. CIA program? Funded. Yes. This is still a hell. Is this still?
Let me read the end of it for you again.
Yeah.
Just sit right there, and I'll tell you how I became the pilot of a highly advanced CIA-funded helicopter weapons program.
Yeah, no, I'm not going to get past it.
I was going to say, if she's too young to know, give me a break. She's too young to know this for sure.
I'll take the compliment that it's because I'm too young and not just because I'm ignorant. I'm not sure I'm too young.
The answer we're looking for was the Fresh Prince of Bel-Airwolf.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Classic 80s schlock. All right, that is round two done. We're now moving on to round three called One and Done. Both of your shows in your mashup are one season cancellations.
Okay.
Both parts. Sarah. Referencing Caesar's point of no return, an intelligence analyst, with help from a trench-coated occultist, discover a conspiracy committed by a secret society of war profiteers. I'll read that again for you.
Thank you.
Referencing Caesar's point of no return, an intelligence analyst, with help from a trench-coated occultist, discover a conspiracy committed by a secret society of war profiteers. Both shows, one season wonders.
Yeah, but that's what's throwing me off, because I want to say Homeland of the Lost, but that's incorrect. So I don't know the answer to this.
It's like Rubicon something, right?
The answer we're looking for, Ruba Constantine.
Oh!
Rubicon and Constantine.
I thought Rubicon had two seasons, but okay.
No.
Just
wouldn't have gotten it anyway. It doesn't matter.
Tara.
Yep.
This retro drama sees a group of stewardesses brutally murdered by corrupt and supernatural sheriff Caleb Temple when they land in Trinity, North Carolina.
Oh my God. Well, it's Pan Am.
Hmm.
Oh, I don't know what the other half is. I don't know.
Anybody know it?
Nope.
Pan American Gothic was the show we were
This is like, are we supposed to remember all the show? If we remembered all the shows that have been canceled, like, we wouldn't know, like, our relatives' names. Like, that's so many.
See if you can get this one. It's our last one and done. It's for Willa.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
A group of U.S. intelligence agents takes a break from the European theater to help a couple teenagers figure out all the weird shit happening in their small Midwestern town.
Yeah. These have been, I mean, no. No. I probably know both of these shows. But no idea.
No idea? No idea?
Yeah, yeah.
No.
I'll give you a hint. One of them is recent. Like, very recent.
Oh.
No.
All right, I'll call on this one before you put you out of your misery. Whiskey Cavalieri, Indiana was the show that we
Leary,
were
on. Indiana.
Okay.
All right, that's going to take us to our first score break. Tara, can we get the scores here at our halfway-ish point?
Okay, Willa has 2 points. I have 3 points. Sarah has 4 points.
All right, lots of game left. Lots of game left. Pick back up with round four. It is called Featuring One, Bruce Campbell. One of the shows is a show that Bruce Campbell was in.
I only know one show Bruce Campbell was in, guys. I promise.
I'm concerned.
I'm like, I really like that show, but that's the only one I know.
All right. Well, let's see if you get it. Sarah D. Bunting. A rugged cowboy searches for a mysterious orb from the future while attempting a relationship with the woman he meets at a former girlfriend's wedding.
That was the one I knew.
Uh-huh. Let me read that again for you. A rugged cowboy searches for a mysterious orb from the future while attempting a relationship with a woman he meets at a former girlfriend's wedding.
I am going to be mad, but I can't pull either of these, so buzz me.
I can pull the first one. It's Briscoe County Jr., but I don't know what the second one is.
Tara, do you know... Attempting a relationship with a woman he meets at a former girlfriend's wedding. I know you watched the show.
It sounds like it's not How I Met Your Mother, so I don't know.
The show is made by a friend of all us on here on the podcast.
Oh, The Adventures of Briscoe County Junior. You're the worst.
You're the worst. Oh.
The Adventures of Briscoe County Junior. The worst is the
I think actually
worst.
You're the worst, Dave T. Cole. That was really terrible.
Fantastic.
And awesome.
You. Number 17.
This
Red Eagle.
For Tara.
Yes.
Characters loosely connected with the events of the critically beloved movie gather together in a grief support circle. We don't know this mashup. We don't vouch for it.
Far go on.
Correct. All right, Willa, was Briscoe County the show that you knew?
Yeah, yep. Totally. 100%.
Right. Well, let's see what happens here. A couple of hungry street lawyers with chainsaw hands take on the powers of hell to keep the power of the Necronomicon safe.
This is some Evil Dead thing.
Some Evil Dead thing is the right direction.
Steel meal
from Sarah. Yeah.
This was the one I knew, so I'm going to say it. Franklin and Bash versus Evil Dead.
Franklin and Bash versus the Evil Dead. And that's how you do this.
Gorgeously done, Sarah. You have one steel meal left.
All right, this is round five and question. Round five is called Edutainment. One of the shows is an educational show. One is not. Here we go. Sarah D. Bunting. Teaching kids the value and joy of reading in the age of streaming TV and video games is a challenge made all the more difficult when LeVar Burton is replaced with a self-hating Hollywood addict.
With a self-hating what now?
Hollywood addict.
Okay.
Talk it out. Do you know any parts of that?
I just have one of those crossword blocks where it's like, it's not Sesame Street and it's not...
It's Reading Rainbow, but I don't know what the other one is.
Well, there's a good clue from Willa. Willa's
helping out our front runner.
I mean, against her own interests.
Thanks. Okay. I think I should probably be buzzed for that.
Well, you know, that's her problem.
Oh, no, I was happy to give it to you. I don't have any idea what the other one is.
Thank you. I just can't. I can't pull the
can't
second
pull it?
One.
All right. We'll buzz you on that.
Sorry.
One.
Well, Willa, you have a steel meal left, so you can steal that.
But
if you
I don't,
know it.
I, as if I knew what the second one was. I just know it's Reading Rainbow. I don't
all
know.
Right.
What
well,
Hollywood.
There's only one show that has Hollywood in it right now, and that is Reading Rainbow Jack Horseman.
Oh.
Yeah. All right. Tara, here's your edutainment show. Puppets and cartoons help kids learn to count and spell. The crimes Lieutenant Michael Stone and Assistant Inspector Steve Keller help solve in this foggy West Coast city.
Sesame Streets of San Francisco.
Sesame Streets of San Francisco.
Making it look easy. Making it look easy. Here, I'm here to make it look hard. Go ahead.
All right, well, here's your edutainment question. A young Latina girl teaches kids about geography, criminal foxes, and finding the elusive dragon in a game based off a paper and pencil classic.
All right, so it's Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego?
Let me read that clue for you again. A young Latina girl teaches kids...
Oh, Dora the Explorer. Okay. Good, then do me the rest.
Young Latina girl teaches kids about geography, criminal foxes, and finding the elusive dragon in a game based off a paper and pencil classic.
Criminal and a dragon. What?
Criminal foxes and finding the elusive dragon in a game based off a paper or pencil classic.
A paper? Does that mean like a book? Yeah, no, I don't know. Dora the Explorer. Agon? I don't know.
Anybody?
No.
We were looking for Tic Tac Dora the Explorer. Tic Tac Doe and Dora the Explorer.
Sure.
All right, that's round five. Round six is coming at you. This one's called Write Offs, in which we pair a TV writer with a different TV show.
Oh, okay.
So the answer will be a TV writer and a TV show, not necessarily in that order.
Okay.
Sarah D. Bunting. A collection of fast-talking, witty mothers and daughters are sent into exile into an equally quirky Alaskan town.
Okay.
A collection of fast-talking, witty mothers and daughters are sent into exile in an equally quirky Alaskan town.
Okay, well, Gilmore. It's Gilmore Girls and Northern Exposure. Men Paladino? Northern Exposure Men Paladino?
Sherman Paladino. Oh, as a last name? Okay. All right. Yeah. Okay. Amy Sherman Paladino Northern Exposure.
I mean, okay.
Yeah. I'll give it to you. I'm not happy about it, but I'm going to give it to you. If you win, there's going to be that baseball asterisk.
No, there is not.
Yep.
I can live with it.
I'm joking.
I so seldom win, so let's not worry about it.
Tara.
Yeah.
When the real world of politics gets more ridiculous than his political comedies, he drowns his sorrows at a Boston bar.
Oh, no. What is... Oh, Armando Iannucci.
Wow. Well done.
Yikes.
Willa.
I feel really...
overwhelmed?
Like a dummy right now. Nah, but I'm going to...
You're going to get this one. Ahead. I can feel in my bones.
We'll see.
Willa.
Yeah.
Nancy Botwin and Piper Chapman meet their fate together when calm and collected forensic psychiatrist surgically slices them into thin layers for display.
Oh, it's Genji Co-Hannibal.
Genji Co-Hannibal together at last. Okay. Sarah D. Bunting.
Yeah.
A mushroom-taking, mansplaining walker and talker is given a $5,000 Visa card and cutting sartorial advice. Talk it out.
I can't. I'm laughing. What not to wear in Sorkin?
Yeah.
Great. I would watch the hell out of that.
Tara.
Yeah.
Kind of a tough one. When an attorney played by Jerry Van Dyke purchases a used automobile, he is shocked to discover it is possessed by the person who gave birth to him, the co-creator of the hit show Lost.
My mother, the Carlton Cues.
Wow.
You maniac.
Not okay, Dave.
Last question of a write-off round for Willa.
I'm very impressed with everybody. I'm just saying that, except myself.
A chimpanzee is beheaded in a public square in view of his yellow-hatted best friend after he spies the author writing yet another incest scene.
Say that to me again.
Yeah, a chimpanzee is beheaded in a public square in view of his yellow-hatted best friend after he spies the author writing yet another incest scene.
You know, I don't know at all. Someone do it for me. I know you guys have it.
Anybody? Anybody want to answer that for tits and giggles?
Curious George R.R. Martin.
Curious George R.R. Martin.
I should have gotten that, honestly. I'm mad at myself.
All right, that is it for round six. We're now on to round seven, talk show crossovers. We got a talk show plus another TV show. Sarah D. Bunting.
Mm-hmm.
A talk show host solves last-minute booking problems by being both the interviewer and the animal talent.
The Mr. Ed Sullivan Show? No.
That is not the answer I had, but I'm gonna give you that one because that is pretty great. Another answer that is perfectly acceptable was anybody want to guess? The Late Show with David Lettermanimal.
Oh. I like yours better, but I'll take the point.
Yeah, I know. I mean, it works. Tara.
Yep.
He only uses his tour money for day-to-day expenses and buying cars. He saved all his money from hosting this late-night science series.
The Tonight Show with Jay Leno.
Correct. The Tonight Show with Jay Leno and Nova. Willa, here's your talk show crossover.
Yeah, totally.
A talk show host takes his show on the road to Horseshoe Bay, Maine, and teams up with a local teen detective to solve the case of the coffee table books that didn't sell.
Oh, I don't remember the show that's in Horseshoe Bay. No. Just
do you know the
me.
Other half?
No, like what late night show it is? I feel like you have to know the other one to figure that part out. I could be wrong.
Anybody?
Thank you. Thank you.
Anybody want
Co-Nancy Drew?
Co-Nancy Drew is
oh,
correct.
Nice.
Co-Nancy Drew.
I was good. Like, Drew Carey at a talk show?
All right, we're hitting our last round, the stupidest round of them all. So just before that, let's get the scores, please, Tara.
Okay, Willa has 3 points. Sarah and I are tied with 8 each.
Done!
You guys
so
are very
gotta
good.
Get it.
Sarah, you have 1 steel meal left. I'm just reminding you. I have 0.
I am aware.
Okay.
Ooh, all right, this is round A. It's not easy being cheesy. You're going to merge two shows, and just for fun, you got to add cheese to them.
God.
So somehow you got to change the answer, adding or changing something, so that it reflects the cheesiness in the clue.
Got it.
Okay.
Two shows plus cheese.
Okay.
All right, Sarah DeVante.
Yeah.
An early lesbian icon performs stupid stunts with her friends for fun in England while eating cheese dotted with habaneros and jalapenos. So talk it out for us. What do you think those two shows are?
I need the clue again, please.
An early lesbian icon performs stupid stunts with her friends for fun in England while eating cheese dotted with habaneros and jalapenos.
Okay, well, I feel like I have to get from, like, Ellen DeGeneres to Monterey Jack, and I have no idea what is in the middle. So I don't know. Please tell me the answer.
Anybody?
No.
Gentleman Pepper Jackass.
Oh! Pepper Jack.
Yep.
That's good shit.
Gentleman, yep, gentleman jackass. Good. Then you're going to add a little pepper jack in there. Okay. All right, Tara.
All right, Tara.
Yep.
A singing school club splits its time between being a spreadable soft cow's milk cheese and forming a corporation to compete with Con Ed.
No. Okay.
So talk it out. Like, what do you think those two shows are?
I mean, one is Glee. I don't know what the Con Ed one is, and I have no idea what the spread. I mean, cringe.
I'll read the question for you again, just to make it even.
Okay.
A singing school club splits its time between being a spreadable soft cow's milk cheese and forming a corporation to compete with Con Ed.
I don't know.
The answer we're looking for in its fullness is Bree Electric Company, Glee, the Electric Company, Glee Electric Company, Bree Electric Company.
Wow. Insane. I think you might have outthought us.
I don't understand that one. It's the Brie Electric Company, but you don't have to say Glee?
No, we just changed Glee to Brie.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right.
Sure. Well,
Kelvin Ball. I don't know what's happening.
A Southwestern mob lawyer in exile story is told with Greek flair from the iconic chair of America's favorite sexist and racist.
Whoa, so Feta's in the middle. Okay, so Better Call. Who's America's favorite sexist and racist?
Where's the cheese go?
Feta's in there, right?
The iconic chair of America's favorite sexist and racist.
Oh, I got it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Do it. Give up. Do it.
All right, Tara, what do we got?
Well, I don't know. Sarah, you going to steel meal it? You don't got to?
No, because I don't know where the cheese goes.
Feta Call Saul in the Family.
Oh! Feta Call Saul.
All right, I think we have a tie, but let's get those scores.
That's true. Willa has 3 points. Sarah and I are still tied with 8 points each.
Do you have a tiebreaker?
I do have a tiebreaker. So Willa, you can take a knee as our tied for first place people. First person to shout out the correct answer. We're going back to write-offs, so we have a writer and a TV show combined.
Oh, God.
Okay.
First person to shout out the correct title will win today's game.
Okay.
The creator of The Wire teams up with the creator of Treme to open a private investigation business.
David Simon and Simon.
David Simon and Simon is correct.
Sarah.
Congratulations, Sarah. And I'm so glad that you all got to experience...
Mr. Ed, I couldn't have done it without you.
My 3 a.m. fever round that was the cheese round.
Very well done game, Dave.
That is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. We took a bite of Apple's new streaming service shows, including The Morning Show, C, For All Mankind, and Dickinson. Sarah took a solo trip around the dial, rising to the occasion with a sweet presentation of the Great British Bake Off Final. Listener Kit proved that American Vandal's fifth episode, Premature Theories, was canon worthy. We crowned winners and losers of the week, and Sarah was the winner of this week's Game Time. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Ariano.
How psyched is Sue gonna be when I dig up this baby?
Sarah D. Bunting.
Get me some fucking butter, man.
And Willa Paskett.
You guys are crazy good at trivia.
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time right here on Extra Hot Great.
Hey, just do yourself a favor. Try to be more agreeable, for Christ's sake.
I am fucking agreeable.